Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. So keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left. Speaking today with John Anderson. John Anderson is a former Republican member of Congress for 20 years, an independent presidential candidate in 1980 when he received 7% of the vote. He's now a professor of law at Nova Southeastern University and serves as president of the World Federalist Association, the chief American lobby for strengthening world government. Welcome, John Anderson.
Thank you very much.
Now, the selection of George Bush in his by the Republican faction of the Supreme Court was a pretty dark day for Federalists because his administration moved us in a much more unilateralist direction, probably the most isolationist move that we've been position we've been in since the 1930s. Then, since September 11th, we've moved into a staunchly multilateralist posture. This is a time when world federalists should be very much on everyone's minds, but is it a difficult time for us because of the combination of having a regime which is actually hostile to any kind of multilateralism, world federalism, and having all the super patriotism? Wasn't this a kind of a complicated time for us to get our message out?
Well, it is complicated in this sense that in the kind of emergency with which we were confronted after the horrific events of the 11th of September, it's true that I think sometimes patriotism comes to be equated with nationalism, and you tend to look almost with blinders at the specific national interest that seems to be threatened, as surely we were with the kind of unpardonable acts that were committed in New York City and here in Washington, and the loss of the other plane as well. But at the same time, in a much broader context, it served to illustrate that in this very, very complicated and dangerous world in which we live today, we cannot and we must not stand alone and apart. Almost immediately, the president, to his credit, began to try to build a coalition of support among the nations of the world, some with which we have not had noticeably warm relations even, but to draw them into this wider cooperative effort that will be required to defeat a world terrorist movement that is literally worldwide in scope. So it sent kind of a mixed message. The events of September 11th sent a mixed message in that regard. And yet, the more that the weeks wear on, and the more evident I believe that it becomes that we will win the ultimate victory not simply by pursuing a narrow nationalistic course where we seek to impose our own will on other countries, but only as we get them to join us in an effort that will eventually, we hope, look beyond the events of the moment to see the necessity of creating through a world organization the kind of world law that can be enforced and enforced with impunity in a way that that will guarantee future peace and protection from the kind of devastation that we've already suffered. So on the whole, on balance, I am encouraged. I think that there is fertile soil out there for an idea that the World Federalists have been pushing almost since day one, if you reckon day one as the date in June of 1945 when the Charter of the United Nations was signed, that we have got to strengthen that organization to the point where we have truly a democratic world federation that is enforcing world law, law that will be applicable to the kind of situation that we're confronted with today and in the future, when men and other nations seek to break the laws of both God and man in the kind of wanton criminal action that has taken place.
A lot of the progressive folks who have been opposed, or pacifist folks who have been opposed to this intervention, have argued that it should be an intervention of international troops, perhaps blue-helmeted UN troops, and that the goal should be bringing Al-Qaeda before the International Criminal Court, which the U.S. has not signed on to. Is this an example of a case in which those very few Americans who aren't happy about this intervention, that the ideal is an enemy of the good? Is it possible that sometimes Federalist-minded folks oppose multilateral interventions for human rights, such as Kosovo, in my opinion, and in this case, Afghanistan, a very multilaterally sanctioned intervention for international justice and human rights and world peace, in my opinion. Is opposition to these on the grounds that they are not full blue-helmet adventures actually very short-sighted?
Well, I think we have to break your question down into two parts. Some of it dealt with whether or not the world was organized in such a way that it could respond immediately and effectively to the kind of challenge that was posed by the bombing and the taking down of the World Trade Center and so forth on September 11th. The second part of your question is, how do you adjudicate once you have apprehended these criminals, and I think that ultimately we will, how do you deal with them? Do you deal with them unilaterally? You seek to impose national punishment, or do you look to a broader world order functioning in a way that it can administer world peace through world law? On the first of them, I think we've got pending a measure in Congress right now. It was introduced in the last Congress, reintroduced in this Congress, has, I think, more than 20 co-sponsors at the moment, that would give the United Nations a peacekeeping force. We called in that legislation, or those who sponsored it called for a force that initially would not be huge in size, 6,000, but well trained and equipped in a way that they could be the world policemen that we have said we do not want to be. The president said, don't call us every time something goes wrong. We don't want to be the 9/11 responders around the world, and I agree on that point. I think it ought to be an international organization. But the fact is, it is not now in being. It doesn't exist. And I don't think we could wait until that legislation had been enacted, until conceivably other nations of the world had joined in similar acts to create this international force. Unfortunately, we had to react rather quickly, as we have done. But ultimately, I think that we ought to be pushing for that kind of peacekeeping force that would operate in the name of the entire international community to respond to the kind of awful things that have just happened. Now, secondly, we have been proposing, for more than a decade, I myself wrote a law review article, believe it or not, that was published exactly 10 years ago, saying that the emergent idea of an international criminal court was an idea whose time had come. So the World Federalist, not just me individually, but through the hard work of its thousands of members, have been working very hard for a long time to bring about something more than the World Court, which can only sit in judgment where cases are brought by one nation state against the other. We need to exert personal jurisdiction over individual malefactors who violate the world law. Even we don't even have to pass new laws. We've got on the books now a treaty that was passed in Rome in 1998, signed now about 140 countries. We're one of them, not yet ratified by the necessary 60, so that it can go into effect, but hopefully will by 2002. And they prescribe that when crimes against humanity are committed, war crimes, genocide, that court can take jurisdiction. clearly what happened on September 11 was a crime against humanity, to wantonly wipe out and destroy the lives of more than 5,000-6,000 innocent people. So that court, if it were in creation, and if it were sitting, would be the appropriate body, surely, to exercise criminal jurisdiction over Al-Qaeda and all of the other members of that international conspiracy.
But would that preclude U.S. suits on U.S. soil and an extradition or arrest, an international arrest?
Well, actually, as the treaty was written, it was prospective. It could not apply to crimes that were committed before the court had actually become effective. And as I said, it takes 60 nations to ratify. To date, more than 40 have done so. But since those crimes have been committed, no, you could have jurisdiction by the nation state, namely the United States in this case. But I think the ultimate goal, we shouldn't lose sight of the ultimate goal, which is to get on with the unfinished work of creating that court so that if we were to have incidents of this kind in the future, that it would not be the United States unilaterally that would be confronted with the obligation to try and convict and sentence these individuals. It would be an international body.
But given the current state of international jurisprudence, it would be legitimate for the U.S. to arrest and try Al-Qaeda in the United States.
Yes, under the current state of international law, it would be. I'm just emphasizing, however, that I think we have to take the long-range view, even in the midst of all of the trauma that we are undergoing now. We can't lose sight of the goal of having that international court functioning, because once it's set up, then I think it would be a terrific way of deterring future crimes of this kind.
Some skeptics have observed that the United States is, or policymakers in the United States, their reluctance to sign on to the idea of an international criminal court may have to do with their suspicion that Americans would be tried in such a court for previous crimes. And in fact, Christopher Hitchens has written a book-length treatment of Henry Kissinger, an indictment of him as an international war criminal. Do you think that this is one of the things that's in the way of American endorsement of this concept?
Well, the treaty makes it clear that it would create a court that would have only prospective jurisdiction. So for whatever offenses Mr. Hitchens and others may think that Henry Kissinger and even others in the American military or political establishment have created or committed in times past would not fall under the jurisdiction of that court. And if in the future we had cases that legitimately could be defined as war crimes, and I remind you that in the language of the treaty, war crimes don't mean an isolated incident of one or a few soldiers misfiring or firing off even deliberately rounds that kill or otherwise injure foreign citizens. A war crime, by definition, has to be a concerted course of action taken by a government with full knowledge of the consequences that it is violating traditional, the Geneva Conventions and all of the other rules that are a part of customary and acknowledged international law. So isolated cases of excessive use of force in connection with the prosecution of a military action would not be actionable under the jurisdiction of that court. So I think this is a red herring that the opponents of the court are throwing across the path in an effort to defeat it. Because there are those people who are so, in my opinion, and forgive me for being totally blunt about it, who are so narrow and nationalistic in their thinking that they make statements that I don't care what an American does, I want him treated under American law in an American court and American justice. If we are going to be a member of the world community, of the international community, if we are going to demand the right, as we should, to try those who offend against this treaty and commit other war crimes and commit genocide, if we're going to demand that they be tried before an impartial international body, we've got to accept the same thing for our own nationals. We can't say that we, as the reigning superpower, are going to demand a law unto ourselves. No, we've got to prove that we are sincerely dedicated to the proposition that the only way to assure world peace in the future is to have world law, and then have that law impartially administered by a tribunal that is representative of the world community.
I'm speaking today with John Anderson. He's a former congressman, independent presidential candidate, professor of law now at Nova Southeastern University, and the president of the World Federalist Association. Mr. Anderson, the debate about what we should do in Afghanistan also extends to the post-conflict resolution, not only the what we do to try these criminals, but what we do with Afghanistan after we defeat the Taliban, the nation building, in other words.
Yeah.
And there's a strong embrace now of the Bush administration of the UN as a nation building force in Afghanistan, which is a role that it's played in a number of different places, East Timor, for instance. Do you think that this is an increasing responsibility that the UN will be called upon to take on to go in after regimes, illegitimate regimes have been toppled, and to create and defend the legitimate regimes?
I do indeed, and that's why I made the point I did initially, at least one of the points that I tried to make, that actually the United Nations is not very well equipped at the moment to carry the very heavy responsibilities that are going to be imposed on it in the future. I think we've got to get busy with strengthening the UN by giving it that police force, and all of this chattering by some people on the far right about black helicopters on the part of the UN taking over the world. Are just seeing ghosts and hobgoblins that they could better save for Halloween a couple of weeks from now. No, the UN needs a respectable world presence. It needs to assume authority to rebuild shattered countries like Afghanistan. And I applaud the administration, and I hope they pursue that goal relentlessly and sincerely, that we are not going to undertake to rebuild that shattered country by ourselves. We are going to ask the world community through the United Nations to contribute to that effort. That's the only way, I think, to deal with these situations. You mentioned East Timor. We've had Sierra Leone. We've had, of course, the Balkans. We've had and have continuing problems in a number of African countries. Look at the anarchy that reigns today still in Somalia, where we picked up and left way back almost 10 years ago after the death of some American soldiers. No, we need a strong and empowered UN, and I'm glad that Congress has finally paid our back dues. I hope that from now on it won't be back dues, it'll be our current dues that we continue to pay and support what ought to be a strong functioning arm of the world community.
The black helicopter folks in the United States, the conservatives who oppose the UN, they have often argued that although the United States will live up to and be forced to by a free press and an open society, forced to live up to any agreements that it signs and treaties that it signs, that other nations, more secretive or dictatorial nations, could sign on to treaties such as conventions against biological or chemical weapons that would hamstring us but would not hamstring them to carry on in secret. And there is some evidence that the Soviet Union ramped up its production of biological weapons after signing an agreement with us, that they would stop that. And so we if we were to push ahead in this coming period with international agreements, we really need to push ahead with enforcement. It's not just a matter of getting nations to sign on. It's really a matter of having the regime of international enforcement. Isn't that the key issue?
Oh, I couldn't agree more. Agreements are simply pieces of paper unless they have built-in enforcement mechanisms. And unless we have a strong, abiding commitment to the principle of the rule of law, that it is law rather than the irresponsible actions of men that are going to govern world affairs. We are a great and a powerful nation today, fundamentally because we have a constitution and a bill of rights that are binding on our president, on our Congress, on our courts, and it's because of that that we have still, after all of the vicissitudes of two centuries, emerged as a strong and living example of what democracy can be. And we haven't finished the job by any means. We're not perfect. I don't mean to imply that we are. But it goes to the point that you made and that I join you in making, that it isn't enough to sign a treaty. We've got to have institutions that are capable then of inspection, of taking action against those who either don't submit to inspection or who have demonstrated that they are in non-compliance with agreements that they have signed. They've got to be dealt with, and it ought to be done in a collective way through a collective judgment of the world community, and we ought to be the leader in that effort for better enforcement of world law.
I've been a world federalist since I was an 8-year-old passing UNICEF boxes for the for my church, and so I've often been at odds with the more anarchistic elements of the progressive politics. But I'm especially disturbed in the current period as the globalization movement has picked up in the last couple of years. Here's a movement that critiques the depredations, the inequalities of global capitalism, the need for some kind of solution to international trade questions and so forth in a more democratic context. Almost none of those folks talk about world federalist solutions, and I think it's largely to do with the influence of an anarchist element in, in those circles. Do you see, what's the World Federalist Association to do, what's the World Federalist Movement to do to reach out to this burgeoning anti-globalization movement and say, look, there are justice-oriented solutions through international institutions?
I think that rather than simply treating them as pariahs who are beyond the pale, we have got to pick out some people in these various groups that have banded together and staged protests and demonstrate to them that we are really with them in the feeling that some things have gone wrong with globalization. The globalizing of the world economy has proceeded apace, but the growth of world law to govern that expanded economic and financial intercourse that is girdling the globe, that has not proceeded apace, and that we are really in the beginning stages with a World Trade Organization, which needs to be democratized. They have a point. I don't think that they make a very good point when they go out and burn down buildings or smash plate glass windows and that kind of thing. I'm as disturbed by that anarchist element as you are. But there are reasonable people that are disturbed about the direction that globalization in an economic sense has proceeded, and we've got to convince them that with proper political institutions, we could govern what otherwise seems to be a world where only the profit line is what people are interested in, and therefore the developing world is suffering, even as the developed world is profiting from globalization. We haven't made the effort that we should, I repeat, to reach out and to try to convince people in that anti-globalization movement that it isn't enough to simply be against something. You've got to be for something as well. You've got to propose some progressive solutions. And I believe that those of us who believe in the cause of a democratic world federation and of building the institutional structure that would support that world community, which we don't have at the present time, present UN is only a pale shadow of what I think we ought to have in the way of institutions that can effectively deal with this enormous problem that you and I are discussing of a globalized economy. We haven't really begun to see the possibilities that exist there for the kind of institutional development that is needed to convince people that, yes, when these world organizations make a decision, they're doing it democratically. They're not just listening to the World Economic Forum that meets in Davos, Switzerland, and is primarily interested in markets and in international finance and so forth. We've got to generate some real interest in democracy and democratic institutions and open up a dialogue that we haven't done. We've been very, very slow to see that, but I think some of us, and I put the World Federalists in that category, realize that we've got to open up those lines of communications with people that have been demonstrating around the world without presenting any clear picture of what solutions they would propose. We've got ideas. We've got to see that we communicate those ideas to those people.
We just have a minute or two left, but I wanted to share with you my own feeling of optimism that since the post-World War II era, when world federalism had its real flowering in the States and around the world, and then immediately a lot of the optimism got dashed on the shoals of the Cold War, now the Cold War is a thing of the past. We've embraced China, the Soviet Union, and a new international coalition. We will look back on 9/11 as the real turning point of post-Cold War history towards a new world order, whatever that turns out to be. Do you have that sense of optimism?
I do indeed. You know, rather than saying that this is the first war of the 21st century, I'm going to say we ought to be working to make it the last war of the 21st century in the sense that one nation becomes the object of attack and has to respond largely initially with a show of the kind of force that we have mustered. I would like to see this the beginning of a really new chapter in international relations. And so, yes, I do share that optimism, and I don't think I'm just being Pollyannish in saying so, that this can open the door to a new vista of what the future can become if we only see beyond the present and are willing to look to the future and the things that have to be done to meet the challenges that that future presents.
I really want to thank you for joining us today, John Anderson. I've been speaking with the former Republican member of Congress for 20 years, former presidential candidate of 1980, professor of law at Nova Southeastern University, and president of the World Federalist Association, John Anderson. Thanks again for being with us.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the A-Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.